Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Joanne Freeman.
I'm Nathan Connolly.
And I'm Brian Ballow.
If you're new to the podcast, we're all historians, and each week, along with our colleague Ed Ayers, we explore a different aspect of American history. This week, Backstory is exploring the history of American profanity. So be warned, there will be profane language. And as historians, we're also mindful of the history of violence and oppression. So there'll be certain words that even we won't say.
Asshole, tits, ass, cocksucker, schmuck, motherfucker, prick, putz, bawling, clap, fag, piss, and son of a bitch.
Those were the words police charged comedian Lenny Bruce with saying during a 1962 performance. Josh Lambert actually gets to say those same words without much consequence today.
It is pretty fun to do it as dispassionately as I can, as if, you know, I do it all the time.
He's a scholar of obscenity, academic director of the Yiddish Book Center, and author of the book Unclean Lips, Obscenity, Jews, and American Culture. Lambert says Lenny Bruce developed a reputation as a so-called sick comic in the 1950s and 60s by pushing the bounds of what could be said out loud in the public square.
I think we can understand that there would have been people around Lenny Bruce's time who would have felt genuinely weird and gross when they heard him say a word like shit or tits or fuck, and they wanted to protect other people from feeling as grossed out or as disturbed as they felt.
Police officers started regularly attending Lenny Bruce's shows, and it wasn't because they were his fans. Cops started staking out his performances, noting what he said, and then arresting him on obscenity charges. In 1964, Lenny Bruce stood trial in New York and became a kind of cause celeb.
Fascinatingly, Allen Ginsberg organizes a committee to sort of advocate on behalf of Lenny Bruce, and he gets all sorts of different people to sign a petition in support of Lenny Bruce, people like James Baldwin and Lionel Trilling and Susan Sontag and, you know, lots and lots of other, you know, major cultural figures. And again, this doesn't mean that they were necessarily friends of Lenny Bruce or even fans of Lenny Bruce, but it was people who felt like the liberalization of obscenity law was an important thing, was an important change in the culture, and it would set that cause back if Lenny Bruce were to be convicted, if people like Lenny Bruce in the future couldn't perform the kind of material they wanted to.
But then Lenny Bruce decided to do something strange.
Lenny Bruce really liked to perform his material to courtrooms, even though it never seemed to work out really well. No judge ever said, oh, great, yeah, you did a few jokes for me. I really appreciate that.
So why does he try to perform his act in court? Josh Lambert has one theory.
Anyone who has like a small child understands this. It's one thing if a kid says a word and you say, don't use that word ever again. But if you say to them, oh, well, there's a whole bunch of words you should never say, their first question is going to be, which ones? And then you have to tell them all the words, which they're, of course, going to say. So I think Bruce understood this, that in calling him out for using a word like motherfucker, the court had to say the word motherfucker over and over again and include it in the trial transcript and publish it. So there was that irony of the only way to punish him for this stuff was to reproduce the language, and thus it sort of undermines the whole idea of shutting him up.
And Lenny Bruce, like perhaps no one before him, managed to shock the country into facing the First Amendment and the fullness of what it represented. But did Lenny Bruce think of himself as a civil rights icon?
I think with any particular choice that he made or moment that he spoke or thing that he said, it's pretty hard to figure out, like, was that, you know, a deliberate act of civil disobedience or was that him just fucking around?
So today on the show, Backstory explores the social and cultural history of some of the most charged profanities in American life.
We'll hear about the long and complicated history of the N-word.
We'll find out what it really meant to swear like a sailor.
And we'll go from sailors to soldiers. We'll discuss how the two world wars gave rise to swearing back on the home front. Okay, team, which group in American society would you say were historically most associated with cussing?
College professors?
Girl Scouts. Must be Girl Scouts.
I didn't ask who listens to Backstory. I asked who does the most swearing historically, and you guys know the answer. It's sailors.
Yes.
Those crusty sea dogs had a reputation for having the saltiest tongues in town. Back in 2016, Ed talked to historian Paul Gilia about this. He explained that sailors' language consisted mostly of curses.
Anybody could swear like a sailor, but sailors had a very special relationship to swearing.
Gilia says American sailors coined some of the most offensive words and phrases in the English language. In fact, as the embodiment of manhood, they had a sort of special license to swear. And their language wasn't just offensive, it was loaded with political meaning. So, what did swearing like a sailor sound like? What was the absolute worst thing you could call somebody in the 18th century?
I was surprised. I was reading in the archives, I was going through all these old logbooks and journals, and one day I kind of was reading this logbook and they said, "Then the captain swore, worse than I ever heard anybody swear before." I'm in the archives sitting at the edge of my seat waiting for this. And then the captain said, "You damn son of a bitch."
Oh, come on, man. That was it?
Is that all? That was it. And so here's a pirate about ready to go kill somebody and take over a ship. And he says, "Let's go get those sons of bitches." I'm going, what does this mean?
So tell me, why were these the worst kinds of swearing that people could imagine at the time? Like, kind of unpack that, as they say. What did each word really mean?
Well, let's start with damn. In the 18th and 19th century, damn was directly connected to a sense of Christianity. You were essentially damning someone to hell. And when you did that, you were putting yourself on the same level as God. And if you put yourself on the same level as God, you are essentially sinning. And this is a pretty strong thing, especially in the period I'm talking about, when even hard-nosed, earthy, bad word, perhaps talk about sailors.
Profane.
Profane sailors still often grew up with the Bible, and that's how they learned how to read, and they were aware of, you know, certain religious teachings, so that they took this stuff very seriously. But the word damn would often be then placed in relationship to other terms. Damn, son of a bitch.
Why son? I mean, why is that the word that would set people up?
I think by using the word son, you were attacking the individual and you were attacking the individual's mother.
Right, now, right.
Sailors were actually very sentimental and very sentimental about home and very sentimental about their mothers. I mean, many of these young men were indeed relatively young when they went to sea, not as young as we might imagine. Often they were 15, 16.
That's young enough, right?
It's
be out
enough
on the tossing ocean with mom very far away.
And their main female attachment at that age would probably be with their mother. And they thought about their mother. They dreamt about their mother. They talked about their mother. So when you start saying, "You damn son of a bitch," when you say "son of a bitch," you're talking about a person's mother. But it also, it's a loaded term. The word "bitch" is a loaded term in ways that we ordinarily don't comprehend.
So Paul, "bitch" being the key word in all of this, why is that the word that is so charged by these sailors at this time?
Well, the technical definition of bitch is a female dog.
Right.
And it's charged because I think in the history of dogs, such as it is, there's an emergence in the 18th and 19th century of kind of a domesticated version of a dog and kind of a mongrel version of a dog.
Right, right.
And the people who domesticated dogs in the United States, the middle class, wanted to control all those dogs in the street. And by using the word bitch, then sailors were kind of saying, "Look, middle class, we're not buying your bill of goods and your attempt to domesticate this world."
But there's also another meaning about the reason that bitch is so charged.
And this is much more important, and it has to do with gender. It has to do with sexuality. Ideas about sexuality were changing in this time period. In the 17th and 18th century, a woman's sexuality was much more openly accepted. By the time you move into the 19th century, in the high, we think Victorianism, women's sexuality is being denied. To call somebody a son of a bitch was emphasizing the sexuality of the mother, but not just the sexuality of the mother, but also an open sexuality, almost like a bestial sexuality.
Like those dogs out on the streets.
Right? Like those dogs out on the street. So to call somebody, you damn son of a bitch, you were saying, your mother is willing to do it with anybody and everybody she runs across. She's like a dog in heat, and you haven't got a clue as to who your father is.
Ouch. So that's pretty potent stuff there, Paul. What other words might people have tried to use that would have been almost as strong?
Calling somebody a puppy. Duels that had been fought between Southerners, right?
Mm-hmm.
And often they referred to each other, oh, you puppy.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, well,
that seems sweet.
So what?
Why would somebody call somebody a puppy and think that was a terrible thing to say?
Because it conjures up in the back of people's mind that you are a son of a dog, right? A little child, dog. You know, a son of a bitch.
I'm seeing a certain theme here.
You might even say this conversation is going to the dogs.
We might. So, did damn son of a bitch have what we would recognize as overt political meaning at this time?
Yes. And I'll give you a very specific example. The Boston Massacre of March 5th, 1770.
Oh.
In the lead up to the massacre, there were a series of confrontations between the British soldiers and the common people, common men mainly. And in these fights, they would often turn to one another and say, you damn son of a bitch. Or some person would get shoved and they say, that's the son of a bitch who knocked me down. And that helps create the electricity that leads up to the evening of March 5th, 1770. When the British soldiers are standing there, confronted by a crowd of a couple hundred people throwing ice and stones at them, and then someone shouts out, damn you! Fire! Damn you! Soldiers fire. And we can only begin to comprehend that when we understand fully what the meaning damn and the phrase damn son of a bitch means in its larger context for that political world.
Paul Gilya is a professor of history at the University of Oklahoma and author of To Swear Like a Sailor, Maritime Culture in America, 1750 to 1850. All right, Joanne and Nathan, we heard earlier in the show about comedian Lenny Bruce. So how about some more comedy?
Yes.
I'm in.
Okay. Here's writer Melissa Moore with a joke.
It's about a man who is overseas, and he comes back to his family, and his family asks, you know, well, how was it? How was your tour? And he's, you know, he's been fighting in World War II, and it's just, it's been terrible. You know, honestly, he's seen all these people die. He's seen starvation. He's seen, you know, just the most horrible things. But, you know, it's his grandma asking, and he doesn't want to tell her about this. So he says, well, you know, the boys sure were funny, Grandma. They just told a lot of good jokes. And his family says, oh, tell us one. And he says, well, gosh, I don't know if I can tell you one because the boys also used a lot of bad language. And then they say, okay, well, just say, if you come to a bad word, just say blank. You know, just skip it, say blank, and then tell us a joke. And he says, okay, I'll do that. So he starts telling his joke, and he says, blank, 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 blankety, blank, blank. Blanking, blanking, blank, 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 blankety, blank, blank, fuck.
Here's more again on why she gets a laugh out of that.
Oh, I just love the idea that there are, you know, worse words than fuck. You know, what are all these words that he's got in there that have more power than fuck?
Joanne, Nathan, want to take any guesses at what the other words might be?
Gosh darn it. Nabbit.
Did you both go to Catholic schools? Well, look, that's as good a guess as any.
So, in reality, this joke features a soldier coming back from World War II with a foul mouth. And I'm guessing this was a pretty common thing for soldiers to bring back the colorful language heard in their barracks?
You got it, Joanne. A few years ago, Moore published a book about the history of swearing. And she says that during the 20th century, the two world wars punctuated a rise in profanity.
The language of soldiers when they came back home after World War I and World War II, that they really brought swearing into the public discourse in a way that it hadn't been before. So in the Victorian period, there were lots of people saying fuck and fucking, and but it really was not at all present in public discourse. It was, you know, extremely, extremely taboo. And when you get people coming back from World War I, they would write memoirs and they'd use some of this language that they, you know, were using on the battlefield in their memoirs, especially after World War II as well. You get, you know, reporters who are trying to really give people a flavor of what it was like, and what it was like was a lot of bad language.
Do you have any sense of what the response on the home front was when these soldiers started coming back and cursing like soldiers?
Well, I think at first it was a little bit of denial, not wanting to accept that this is what the language was. And so the very first memoirs have all the curse words bleeped out, or they have kind of commentary saying, huh. Oh, well, this language, although this is the language huh. they were using, oh my goodness, this is horrible. How could this be? But then going on and printing. So Norman Mailer wrote a memoir in 1948. He's got, you know, tremendous number of fucks in there, but he spells it fug, F-U-G. Huh. People attribute it to different people, but Tallulah Bankhead, she was famously quipped, you know, when she met him, oh, you're the man who can't spell fuck.
Now look, jokes and memoirs weren't the only way soldiers expressed their vulgar vocabulary.
This is a popular song from World War II that expresses a lot of the feelings of helplessness, but also rage that soldiers would have, you know, stuck in this bureaucracy, seeing all these horrible things, participating in all these, you know, incredibly difficult things. And it's called Fuck 'em All. And it goes, sorry, I'm a terrible singer, but it goes basically, fuck 'em all, fuck 'em all, the long and the short and the tall. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, fuck 'em all. That's part of the chorus.
Kind of zingy.
Nathan's speechless.
He's worried his seventh grade teacher is coming out from behind the curtain.
So I'll admit that when I first heard the blankety blank joke from earlier, I thought about another 20th century comedian who was notorious for his language, George Carlin.
Oh, you had a master.
Aha.
So I asked Moore where Carlin fits into all of this when he starts to take the stage in the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah, that was an interesting time because the sort of counterculture of the 60s, in a way, sort of finished off what, you know, the greatest generation started. The people coming back, the soldiers coming back, brought this language into the public sphere. And then in the 60s and 70s, it really started becoming more prevalent. And so George Carlin, for example, had his seven words you can't say on television, which are... Let's see, let me count. Shit, piss, fuck, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. And tits is sort of thrown in there, it seems to me, is slightly a little bit of an afterthought. But so he, you know, had this monologue, and he, in 1973, a public radio station was playing the monologue in the afternoon, and a father was listening to it in the car and heard it with his son, and he complained to the FCC saying, oh my gosh, you know, I don't want to be just listening to the radio and hear stuff like this.
Right.
So this became a court case that went to the Supreme Court. You know, can the FCC regulate this kind of language? Because it's very clear in American law that the FCC can regulate obscenity. But this was something different. This was called indecency. And really, indecency is, you know, language that depicts things in an offensive way. And it basically regulates swearing. So could the FCC regulate swearing? And the Supreme Court in 1978 decided that, yes, the FCC could ban these words on TV and on the radio because they're kind of broadcast into your homes and it's harder to avoid them.
Which, of course, gave Carlin's monologue a whole new life.
Yes, yes. And so people still kind of, it's still sort of a touchstone because now you can go back and think, well, what, you know, can we still not say these words on TV? Well,
no, it became now we iconic. Now, the Supreme Court came down differently in a case called Cone v. California. Can you tell us about that case?
Oh, yeah. That was another interesting one about swearing, where Paul Robert Cohen went into a municipal court, I believe, in California, and he had a jacket on, and written on the back of his jacket, he had put, "Fuck the draft."
This was at the height of the Vietnam War. I think he wore this jacket in 1968, and then the Supreme Court ruled in 1971.
That's correct. Yeah, the court case was decided in 1971. And so he went in there and he was arrested for disturbing the peace with offensive conduct. You know, people thought, oh my gosh, he can't do this. This is offensive to all the, you know, people fighting in Vietnam. And so he was arrested. But, and this case also went to the Supreme Court. They came to a very different conclusion. They decided that this was protected speech, that the First Amendment of the Constitution, you know, says that when possible, you shouldn't abridge people's freedom of speech. Courts traditionally have been quite lenient about what you should be able to say. You know, they try not to circumscribe what people can say. And in this case, they decided that, well, fuck the draft. It is meaningful speech. He's communicating how much he hates the draft. And what's important is that it wasn't what the law calls a fighting word. So fighting words are words that kind of by their very utterance inflict harm, or they are liable to kind of immediately incite a breach of the peace. And so Justice Harlan, who wrote the opinion, has this wonderful line where he says, you know, one man's vulgarity is another man's lyric. And he says, well, if you try to make public discourse so pristine that no one could be offended, no one's ever going to say anything because people get offended. And that's part of having a robust public sphere.
It seems like we see a lot more First Amendment constitutional cases around language. In the 20th century, is there the First Amendment is called the First Amendment because it's been there for a long time. I mean, what is changing in the 20th century?
I think they are a result partly of the swear words coming into the public discourse and people just hearing them in places they didn't before. And, you know, some people being comfortable with this language and using it, and some people going, oh my God, you know, I can't hear that. And so then you get the legal cases.
Well, I know why I swear, but I'm curious to know why people more generally swear and whether that reason has changed over history.
I think the reason has been the same, even though the words have changed, in that swear words are kind of the best words we have to express extreme emotion. Because they basically are kind of stored and processed differently in the brain, and they're more closely connected to our emotions. And so I think, you know, while in the Middle Ages you might have said, you know, God's bones when you were really angry or really happy, you know, you were doing it for the same reason that somebody today says fucking, you know, again, for joy or for pain or for anger. All these emotions are very well expressed by swear words.
Yet, when you characterize swearing among soldiers, you talk about swearing being so common that actually, if you really wanted to get someone's attention, you didn't swear. I think the example you use is, you know, get your fucking rifle. When someone said, get your rifles, that was serious. Do we risk losing swearing's special place by it becoming so common?
I mean, I think we are seeing the decline of the sort of sexual and certainly the excremental words. So I think shit now is much less powerful than it was in the Victorian era. Fuck is getting less powerful. And then eventually, once it gets these very different uses, it gets used more commonly, and then the power goes down because you just hear it so often. But I mean, I'm not worried about swearing in general because I think we'll come up with, you know, we're going to come up with some new words.
The last time you dropped a hammer on your toe, what did you say?
Probably motherfucker. Sorry.
It's all right.
Melissa Moore is the author of the book, Holy Shit, A Brief History of Swearing.
When Elizabeth Pryor was a first-year history professor at Smith College, an incident occurred in her classroom that shaped the course of her career. While she was teaching about the Civil War, a well-meaning white student interrupted her lecture to recite a quote from Blazing Saddles, a movie that was co-written by Elizabeth's father, famed comedian Richard Pryor.
I was making a point in the lecture about citizenship, and she repeated a line from the film that used a disparaging word for people of Chinese descent and the N-word. And she said, "We don't want the CHs and the N-words, but we will take the Irish." But she said all the words. And I tried to stop her. I was like, "Wait, wait, wait, wait." And she said, "Oh, no, it's a joke from Blazing Saddles." And then she repeated it. And it was the end of class, and I went home, and I came back to class the next session, and I told everybody, "We're not going to use the N-word. We're not going to say the N-word, the actual N-word. We're not going to talk about it." And I just felt totally empty because I'd basically censored the word in my class, and I hadn't taken the opportunity to really teach the students why that moment was so significant. Like, why was it important that somebody said the N-word in the class? And I didn't give them anything. I just stopped it.
After the incident, Pryor set out to develop a strategy for navigating racist language in her classroom. She began by asking herself, what does the N-word even mean? And while her research centered on this simple question, she ultimately found something far more complicated.
I love doing these like digital newspaper searches online. And so the first thing that struck me was that every time I saw the N-word in print, the actual N-word, it was in quotation marks. I thought it was going to come across like just white people using it in common parlance. But in fact, the only time they really used it up until the 1820s in the newspapers was when they were quoting fictional black people. So, like, they'd write these faux letters to the editor, like, you know, "Dear Massa Printer," you know, like these kind of anti-black kind of diatribes where they'd imagine the black person writing these letters to the newspaper. And in all of those, they had figures who called themselves a poor N-word, using, of course, the actual word. And then increasingly, like at the rise of the minstrel show in the 1820s and 30s, it was in the title of the shows. It was imagined as the words of black people speaking in anti-black art. It was coming out of the mouths of black people. That really struck me. I felt like there was some kind of meaning in that, and I wanted to find out more.
So to your reading, you found it being used by whites imagining how black people were speaking or speaking to each other.
That's right, but I also started thinking about when whites are quoting black dialect, whether or not black people actually spoke that way or not, right? So I started to wonder, could this have been a black word? And I started to look into black sources to try to, and there aren't a ton, but to try to find if there was evidence. My greatest example of this comes from the 1930s WPA ex-slave interviews with formerly enslaved people. And these are people who are, you know, 60 years, 70 years away from enslavement. And they are still using the N-word in incredibly nuanced ways to describe themselves and other people. It does not always mean the same thing. Sometimes it's obsequious in the way that you would expect perhaps it to be, but other times it speaks to pride, lament, spirit. The best example of this comes from a gentleman in the Virginia Narratives, and he's telling this horrible story about what he witnessed as a child, the violence against another enslaved grown-up. And the guy was trying to protect his wife, and the overseer was coming after his wife. And he's the whole time he's telling the story, he's calling the guy a colored man. Right? He's like, the colored man was doing this, the colored man was doing this. And then finally, the colored man stood up to the overseer, and the overseer shot him dead. And at this moment, the storyteller says, N-words don't get no breaks. And it was seemed like a real pointed turn there of using the word. And so I felt like I could really hear that nuance and that history throughout my reading of people speaking and saying the N-word.
So this is a case of there not just being a kind of appropriation from white stereotypes of black speakers, but that African Americans have a long oral tradition that recognizes multiple meanings and uses of a term that might appear the same way in print on its face.
Exactly. And I think the reason why it's important to make that distinction is because in one version, basically, you're saying that, you know, Black people in the late 20th and early 21st century are defining themselves against white racism. And in another version, if you look, you can say there's a long, long history of kind of this linguistic, this discursive subversion that Black people employed way back to the 1770s and 1780s to use this word to start identifying themselves as sort of an in-group, that it they imbued it with meaning. So if anybody did the reappropriating, I think, it's the white people who saw that this was a word that had meaning and texture for Black people, right? And that threatened. That became a big source of the threat. And that's when the word kind of turns into something violent against them. And in fact, a lot of times my students will say, yes, I know what the N-word means. It comes from slavery. And part of the argument that I make is, yes, this is a word that was probably Latin roots. It was applied to people who were involuntary laborers. They were in service in perpetuity. They were Black. But it was a real labor category. People occupied that labor category. It wasn't something you'd want to be, but it wasn't a slur. The word really emerges as a slur as Black people start to become free. This is when the word is used against people who are no longer occupying that actual existing labor category. And that's when the word takes on the meaning that we start to recognize and know it as today.
So give us an example of how Black laborers in these earlier uses would draw out the N-word as a way to convey a shared social identity.
So there is some of this work that's speculative, but I still believe it. And and part of the sources I use, my favorite sources, come from Black authors writing during the period. And they're still writing in a type of dialect. But one of my favorite examples comes from Harriet Wilson, who was a free woman, ostensibly a free woman. She was really an indentured servant in the North and wrote a book called Our N-Word. She wrote this book about being an indentured servant to a white family in the North. But at the beginning of it, she's a biracial person, and her father was Black, and her mother was a white woman who had hit really hard times. And she imagines a conversation that her father, who was a craftsman, was having in his shop to himself when his buddy, also Black, walks in on him. And so she imagines her father, who's sitting there, you know, hooping a barrel, and he's talking about wanting to marry Mag Smith. So he's like, mumbling to himself about this. And his friend Pete walks in and he says, who you gonna marry, Mag Smith? And the father says back, what's up, N-word? Why are you walking up on me like that? And then the friend says something back, and he said, next time you walk in without, you know, permission, let an N-word know it. So in that case, you know, she's imagining Black people in the North. Now, one is Black people in the South, one is Black people in the North, you know, talking to each other, workers, communicating to each other in this casual way. It's not offensive. It's in one instance, it's playful. In one instance, it's chastising, but using it among each other freely. So that's where the evidence comes from.
Right. And I'm guessing you also have moments where you see then a spike in negative uses, largely from white intellectuals or groups. I mean, how do you track when you have a struggle over the meaning of this word where whites are involved?
Right. Well, I mean, basically, as soon as Black people start becoming free, the word changes in tone and tenor. And what's interesting about it is that this becomes a really tricky moment for Black abolitionists, Black people who are rising out of this working class. They don't want to be associated with the word. The first run of Freedom's Journal, which is the first African-American newspaper from 1827 to 1829, does not use the word. They complain about racism a ton, right? And they talk about being called terrible things,
right,
but they don't use the word to say it. It does appear in Colored American, which is the next black newspaper, which runs from like 1837 to 1839 or so. And they talk about being called and accused and kind of blamed through this language. But it really becomes like the international black abolitionists like Frederick Douglass who really start to give the white use gravitas. And I think just like it's whites in blackface who are the first to use the N-word against black people, it's black people in a kind of white face, and I didn't come up with this term, but a kind of white face that they are also only quoting, these abolitionists are only quoting the N-word as white speech. So they're saying here's these examples. This is how white people talk to us. And Frederick Douglass writes a letter to William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist editor of The Liberator, from Ireland when he's abroad. And he uses the phrase, "We don't allow N-words in here," 9 times to describe the kinds of experiences he had trying to cross the thresholds of public space and public transportation in the antebellum North. "We don't allow N-words in here." And that from all kinds of white people, he's hearing that. So I think in some ways, it's the black abolitionists who make everybody aware that this, that the N-word is being used in this violent kind of way. And they also, for the most part, push down the black use.
So I have this notion that I've certainly seen in crowded conversations about the N-word or thinking about history. There's a certain kind of unease, or when, again, you're reading in a class, you know, primary documents where the word kind of jumps off the page and how students respond to it, right? Mm-hmm. And my sense, at least, is that, you know, the N-word is the only word in American English that can so violently and dramatically collapse the past and the present.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the principal reason why it is so destabilizing to the ear for so many people, right? That there's a way in which we've comforted ourselves with a certain distance from the 19th century or the Jim Crow period, and yet that word immediately, you know, causes us to conjure images of the water hose and the lynching tree and the dogs. And so, you know, therefore, it best not be uttered because we can't handle that kind of violent return to the past. And I'm curious to get your sense of that and of its power in that way.
Well, you're 100% right. I mean, it is in the dusty pages of books. It's in this past space that you're talking about. But when it finds its way in full into the classroom, it is in real space, in real time, doing work, real work. Any teacher who thinks that's not true, any teacher who's teaching Huck Finn this week to their students and thinks it is not true that by that word entering their classroom, that the tenor of the classroom has changed, is absolutely mistaken. I have a student who wrote a blog post for me. I taught a course last semester, History of the N-Word. And the one of my students wrote this beautiful, beautiful story about how they had a teacher who taught To Kill a Mockingbird, and they did the read aloud. And the teacher insisted that everybody in the class say the word in full. This was a teacher who believed that it was part of the fight against its violence to repeat it in the classroom space, that Harper Lee had wanted it that way and that it was powerful to do it. And the way that the student would respond was that they would count the paragraphs. You know, everybody read a paragraph. So they would count the number of paragraphs in the book, and they would count when it was their turn. And if their turn coincided with a paragraph with the N-word, they would get up and go to the bathroom, just walk out of the room. And I have heard from students over and over and over again. I mean, this is really why the work became exciting for me, because I thought that what I was going to do when I started having these conversations with students, that they were going to kind of like have this very intellectual freedom of speech debate with me about whether or not you say it or don't say it or whatever. And some have. But most of them like immediately started confessing. That happened to me. I was in a class when that happened. I didn't know what to do when it was said in this way. People tell me to shh, but nobody told me what it meant. You know, on and on and on. And I was like, there's really a story here. And it's like the N-word is sort of like a map into each of our individual racial mm-hmm. histories. So I often say that it signposts a national trauma, but it's also signposts a personal trauma for a lot of people. A lot of people remember their first interactions with this word, not just Black people.
Well, keeping with the personal, I mean, your father was one who tried to, again, bring to the public conversation all the ranges in which Black folks were using this word in private spaces, on street corners and the like. And yet, you know, quite famously, Richard Pryor also had a conversion experience on this very term after taking a trip to Kenya. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I love this. So in 1974, my dad releases the album That N-Word's Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It is such a beautiful kind of description of what an N-word is, like nothing like what white people were saying N-words were. And then 4 or 5 years later, my father goes on this trip, and he has really like an incredible epiphany. He tells it beautifully on stage in Live on the Sunset Strip, and he also does an interview in Ebony in 80 with Lerone Bennett Jr. And he also pulled me aside when I was, you know, 11 or 12, when he came back from this trip, and he told me he was never going to say the word again. But I love what he says. He says, all of a sudden, he was sitting in the lobby of the Nairobi Hilton, and he looks around, and a little voice says to him, look around, what do you see? And he says, I see all kinds of Black people doing all kinds of things. And the voice says, do you see any N-words? And then my dad says, no. And he said, that's because there aren't any. And when he, you know, talks about this, he says, I was wrong. I was wrong. And I think that's so beautiful. I love a couple of things my dad does in this. One is, unlike a lot of people who get into this polemical debate about who should or shouldn't say the N-word, my dad's like, do what you want to do. But this is what, right. this is my truth. I don't want to do this anymore. This is what's true for me. And he also says, and a note to the hip white people who want to come up and use this word with me, please don't, because I don't like it. That's what he says. And I think those are really two very important points. I mean, this is like really this kind of homecoming experience from this perspective, this kind of diasporic experience. He's standing in Africa when he has this epiphany. It's very powerful.
Elizabeth Pryor is a professor of history at Smith College. She's the author of The Etymology of the N-Word, Resistance, Language, and the Politics of Freedom in the Antebellum North. So, folks, we've talked about a lot of different thorny and troubling topics on Backstory and some fun stuff. And this is something that could potentially be fun. And yet we've been pretty tied up in knots about how to handle something like cursing. And I'm curious, given what we're used to dealing with, why this presented such a challenge for us.
Not since our producers told us we were doing a show on the history of fashion have I been so nervous. And I still am tied up in knots. I just interviewed people who used language that I would never use in public, I would never use in private. And I kind of felt like if I'm embarrassed by this, I don't want to impose that on our listeners, even though we warn them up front.
But you know what's so striking about that is, think about the power of those words. The amount of energy that we are now expending trying to decide if we should say them or not. Think about what that says about how powerful those words are.
Some of those words have deep historical meanings, and some of them are what should we say, kind of disembodied or disconnected from particular historical moments?
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be certain histories that and images and parts of the past that get conjured by certain curse words. And so certain words are innocuous. You know, you think about a word like piss or shit that doesn't really carry the same kind of gravity as the dreaded quote-unquote N-word, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or any number of words associated with gay people or women. You know, there's a violence that's behind the language, and there's a violence that often accompanied the use of particular kinds of terms that I think at a visceral level we're all aware of. And so mm-hmm. rather than take that lightly, I think we enter the conversation about cursing with a certain amount of caution. Yeah, I think that that's important. You know, I got to share with you guys something around this as well. You know, I had a chance to teach an FBI file of the Tulsa race riot of 1921.
Wow.
And reading the FBI file is a remarkable window into the politics of cursing, it turns out. So this is from the 1921 episode, the riot in Tulsa. And the agent is giving what seems like a pretty clinical account. And he's talking about the sheriff and the local county marshal and other law enforcement. And he's using air quotes or, you know, quotes around the word, the N-word. And they're as they're talking about a lynching that they're trying to execute against an African-American who was accused of assaulting a white woman. And eventually the quotation marks just disappear. And the agent himself simply uses the N-word as a pronoun for the African-Americans he's describing in Tulsa. There's a second aspect to this, which is in order to justify the actions that are taken by the white mob, the field agent describes how many African-Americans in response to the threatened lynching were basically muttering and cursing. And that's a quote, an armed Negro standing off to one side, muttering and cursing. And this was in the presence of white women. And it was a way of capturing this as a particularly unrespectable group of black people who might have, in fact, been deserving of what happened in the subsequent aftermath of the riot.
Nathan, I have to ask, when do the air quotes disappear?
Well, if you can imagine a 14-page document, it's about on page 2.
Uh-huh.
Oh. But is okay.
But what is your hypothesis as to why he just drops the pretense?
Well, I actually think it's because, you know, the government and the agents of the government in 1921, you know, law enforcement, by and large, are, you know, adopting racist ideas. And, you know, mm-hmm. they can pretend to have a certain objective distance, but, you know, this is a word that they're quite comfortable using.
It wears off by page 2.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And it becomes a simple synonym for people of color, and black people. But this is one of those things that, again, I think it speaks to our own struggles with this, is that, you know, sometimes when you get a little bit familiar, when you get deeper into the conversation, you let certain kinds of decorum slip, right? And I wonder if there's a certain feeling that we have about being on the airwaves, right, about being recorded, that might be different if we were in informal conversation and letting the words kind of fly fast and loose.
You would think that being on the airwaves, whether that means radio or TV, would mean that you would be hyper-conscious. However, I can say that I have the honor of having been bleeped for profanity on PBS.
Joanne.
And it's shocking. Well, and after I did it, I worried about it for like 3 months until the show aired because I thought, oh my gosh, what does it mean? Are people going to look down on me for having said the word? It was a documentary about Alexander Hamilton, and I was asked what people at the time thought about him. And it's not even that horrible a word. And I said, oh, people at the time considered him an arrogant, irritating asshole. And when I watched the documentary, asshole was bleeped.
Right.
And it was fascinating to me that I uttered it. I was trying to capture the strong emotion of people at the time. Then it suddenly caught me up in it, and I began to be really worried about what people would think that I used it. And then I became sort of bizarrely proud of myself for having gotten the bucket list accomplishment of being bleeped on PBS. But there was a lot more engaged with saying that word than I would have assumed there would be.
So is there something about cursing that we can put into perspective? In other words, to say that there are certain words that, you know, in some ways, in the case of someone like Hamilton, you know, for the sake of history, we just have to say, be willing to say, there's something unique about how Hamilton's character that's captured by the term asshole. And is it historians' discretion, basically, to say, well, I'm being the most accurate when I roll out these particular kinds of words?
Well, I mean, here's the thing that strikes me about all of these words. I kind of hinted at it earlier. You know, I said how powerful they are and how striking that is. But part of the reason they're powerful, as you suggested before, Nathan, has to do with the historical baggage. Part of it has to do that these are words that inherently have so much emotion attached to them. And whether that's mm-hmm. anger or hatred or passion or fear, they kind of zoom in on something that's really powerful and direct, which I did without even meaning to when I was trying to capture people's feelings about Hamilton during that early time period. But that's part of what gives them their power, is that in and of themselves as words, they're such powerful emotional statements.
So I think we're in a moment now where we're coming to a crossroads as a society about what words we'll consider to be profane. Because, you know, infamously, I suppose now, the president was heard in what was presumed to be a private conversation in a very public setting, but not recorded, calling people or calling countries from the southern part of the world shithole countries. And news organizations had to figure out if they were going to bleep or to say the word and what the politics around that were. As a candidate, Trump used foul language and was caught on tape using that. And again, news organizations were forced to think about that. And now again, with a more recent speech at the Convention for Conservatives in Baltimore, Maryland, he was caught saying bullshit. And the news organizations yet again had to figure how to carry the words of the leader of the country. And I guess my question is, in light of all these, you know, now serial crises of censorship and language, are those terms going to be considered more acceptable? If you run that on mainstream media, does it lose the taboo of saying a word like shit or bitch or bullshit?
You know, it's interesting. I totally agree with that we become familiarized with them. And the more we become familiarized, the less bad or, you know, banned they seem, and the easier it is for us to say them. But at the same time that is the case, and that might become the case with the word bullshit, the fact that the president said that word suggests something about his character, which is why, you know, I think it's important for us to know that he said that word, right? So that at the same time that we're stating here that him saying that might make it not mean something, the fact that he said it does mean something at this current moment, and that both of those things are true at the same time.
So you guys are not going to like this question, but I'll ask both of you.
Uh-oh.
Doesn't the fact that he said that make him even more authentic to at least 45% of the American public?
The data on this is clear, right? You're more trustworthy, right? If you're caught cursing. And so, it means somehow that you're telling the truth because you're not, you know, using elliptical language or spinning tails.
You're not censoring yourself.
I'll point to a historical moment that strengthens what you just said, and that's Richard Nixon cursing like a sailor in the Watergate tapes, not in public.
Right. Mm.
Right? And so what Donald Trump is doing in some ways is being authentic by using the same language ostensibly, although it may be far worse in private, using some of the same language that he uses in private in front of millions of people. And that adds to this patina for some of, quote, authenticity.
Because he said it, because it, number one, will, as you're suggesting, Brian, will make him seem authentic, but also because it is still a dirty word, that part of what he accomplished by saying it, and I believe he said it more than once, is that it will stand out to people because it's not normally what you expect someone to say.
Right.
And when we think about the things he was saying it about, the Mueller investigation, that's the word that's going to pop into our heads.
Yes, it's a bullshit witch hunt.
Right, exactly. Exactly. That's it for us today. But you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter @backstoryradio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Provost's Office at the University of Virginia, the Johns Hopkins University, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is professor of the humanities and president emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is professor of history and American studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.